This is Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. On our program, we spotlight the art and science of peacemaking throughout history and in our lives today. Whether it's the search for inner peace or learning how to resolve conflicts we have with others in our families, workplaces, communities, or between nations, we consider it here on Peace Talks Radio. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls. Today, if we teach our children early to practice compassion to animals and all living things, and practice such compassion ourselves, will we be creating a more peaceful world? There are studies that suggest a link between abuse to animals and violence to people. So could practicing conscious compassion to animals lead to practicing more compassion to people? Not many would argue that thesis, but are we alert enough to recognize those teaching moments with our children and in our own lives? Later in our program, we'll hear from a panel of guests from organizations that advocate for humane treatment of animals and have programs for children and adults to help raise awareness about the societal value of such compassion. But we're going to start with this question. How far are we willing to go to practice compassion, not only to our pets, but to all other living creatures? Can we literally not hurt a fly, a cockroach, a wasp, a mouse? Our host Carol Boss talked with Buddhist scholar and meditation teacher Eric Kolvig, who says at his retreats, that question comes up fairly often.
Actually, the question goes right to the heart of the Buddha's teachings. And so lots of people come with that kind of dilemma. What I say to them is we talk about ethics, and essentially all of the Buddhist teachings and all of the Buddhist practice is about trying to increase happiness and reduce suffering. Everything is about that. And so Buddhist ethics is based on trying to bring more happiness into the world through your speech and your actions and to reduce suffering. From our perspective, any sentient being deserves respect. And so we try as much as we can not to harm insects or any other living being.
Are there exceptions at all? Because we have circumstances, for example, a family's on a camping trip and they're being swarmed by mosquitoes. They're attacking. What do individuals in that case, for example, do?
I think it's helpful for individuals, if they happen to be Buddhists, to remember essentially the Buddha said because of the law of karma, the law of cause and effect, that what you do comes back to you. In the Christian tradition and Jewish tradition, it's what you sow, you'll reap. Because of that, the Buddha said, whatever you do to yourself, because it will come back to you. So just out of self-interest, you do whatever you can not to kill those mosquitoes. And obviously, in this area around ethics, at least in our tradition, everybody makes their own choices. And it's not about right or wrong or good or bad, or you're a bad person because you've done something. It's just, you know, have you done something that leads to suffering or have you done something that leads to happiness? I make every effort I can to brush off mosquitoes and not to swat them.
And in the instance, maybe there are swarming bees around your house and there's a child who is highly allergic to bee stings or insects that are actually poisonous. In your own mind, there is no exception. You're going to do whatever you can.
I can't say how I'm going to respond in a given situation. If I'm in a reactive state, if I'm having a lousy day, and I'm feeling angry and stressed, I'm much more likely to swat at a mosquito, for example. And so it's not that there aren't exceptions. It's possible that, you know, the example you've given, if there's a child who might die because of a bee bite, I can certainly understand people choosing to get rid of the bees. My suggestion would be, can you remove the beehive without killing the bees? It's possible. And I think just to go to that place.
Kids love to smush bugs, to kill bugs. What is that about? What do you think?
I think it's about power. I think that children in our society, especially in our society, don't have much power. They're more or less discounted. They're not seen on some level. And so when everybody's got power over them, all of those adults and maybe their older siblings, the one thing they have power over are the smaller creatures. And again, if those children had a sense of the intimacy of all things, they also would refrain from that kind of harming. But I think it's essentially saying, okay, I've got the power of life and death over this creature.
So you think in ways that would be something that would need to be learned by them?
In this society, it's something that would have to be learned. If you went to a Buddhist society like Burma or Cambodia or Thailand, where children are taught non-harming from birth, their relationship to insects may be different if they essentially take in the values of the culture. Our culture doesn't really have those values, at least not at a deep a level. A great Buddhist teacher from the 13th century, Dogen, said famously, "The awakened mind is intimate with all things." And essentially what happens is that we are able to harm living beings, other humans and other living beings, including insects, because we feel somehow separate from them and they're somehow other. And as you go deeper and deeper into this practice, that sense of separation falls away, and more you feel connection, so that at the deepest level, at the deepest level of intimacy, you no longer distinguish between self and other. When you get to that place, you would as much, for example, kill another living being, including insects, as you would kill yourself, or I would kill you, Carol. So it's as we go deeper and deeper into this practice, it becomes more and more difficult. It's not an intellectual question. It's something we feel in our whole minds, our whole hearts, and our whole bodies. I'd like to give you an example. I led a meditation retreat recently, and a man came who has worked for years in a library. And for years in the library, when he's seen a wasp, he's grabbed a Kleenex, he's grabbed the wasp and crushed it and thrown it away. So he's been doing this for years, but he's doing more and more spiritual practice. He's going deeper and deeper into the understanding of intimacy. A few months ago, he saw a wasp, he grabbed a Kleenex, he was reaching for the wasp, and he saw that the wasp was looking directly at him, and it was moving its feelers toward him. And he had a sudden impulse not to hurt it, but it was too late. There was too much momentum in the gesture. He grabbed it, he squeezed it, he killed it, and he felt anguish afterward. And his understanding, essentially, he made intimate contact with the wasp. And he now knows that the wasp feels fear and the desire to live as much as he does. So that's that sense of intimate connection, which makes it more and more impossible to cause harm. He's described that incident as a life-changing incident for him. And I'm going to guess that he'll never kill another wasp.
There are a lot of spiders in my house, and I wind up capturing them in a jar, and I take them outside. And actually, when I'm really thinking about what I'm doing, they are such moving moments for me to let this creature free.
Yes, actually, it's a beautiful story, and I'm so glad we're talking about this, because it's not just about being nicey-nice. It's not about goody-two-shoes, we're going to keep the spiders alive. It actually brings us happiness to support the life and happiness of other beings. And if I can just give you an example, I was backpacking in the Grand Canyon many years ago, and I was at Cottonwood Camp, right at the bottom of the Grand Canyon, deep in the wilderness, but they happened to have a working urinal in there. And in the morning, I was using the urinal, and I looked down, and there was a scorpion caught in the urinal. And I went to the ranger, and I said, what do we do? And she said, just flush it down. And I went and got sticks, and I very carefully, it took a long time because, you know, it was a scorpion with sticks. You know, in all the urine, I managed to get the scorpion, take it out, and release it. And it went sort of dragging off, you know, dragging wet behind it. And I can't tell you the happiness I felt. And that was 28 years ago, and I still feel connected to that scorpion.
So that brings up the alternatives that exist, because some people, like the rangers, will think there's no choice. Well, of course, you flush it down or you kill it.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk about the whole idea of perhaps reaching for a cup and capturing an insect, spider or a wasp, and freeing it outside?
Yeah, it's actually we're creatures of habit. And if we have the habit of killing, we will continue killing. And we can establish the habit of catching and freeing, you know, and that habit is very deeply conditioned for me. You know, you can actually get a butterfly net and catch the flies in your house no matter how fast they are. For years and years now, I've captured the insects in my house and released them, including the black widow spiders. I have a little bug catcher, actually, that's battery-powered. It sucks the bugs in, and then you take them out and you release them. And so it's just really about establishing the habit. And my suggestion to anyone who's listening who hasn't tried this, next time you see a spider, you know, get a glass and a piece of paper, get the spider under the glass, slip the paper over the top, and take it out and release it, and notice how you feel when you take it out and release it.
Did you have a moment in your life, perhaps after practicing and studying Buddhism, where you had a life-changing experience?
That's a really beautiful question. I grew up in rural New Hampshire in the 1940s and 50s, and it was very much a hunting culture. It was simply assumed that men, it was really part of your identity as a man to be a hunter. And I resisted that from the time I was a small child. But at some point when I was around 9, my brother had gone out duck hunting with a friend of his, and I felt left out. So I grabbed a rifle. I went to a crow blind that my brother had. This was when I was 9 years old, thereabouts. And I was sitting quietly in the blind waiting for crows to come, and a quail actually walked into the blind. It was about 2 feet from my extended feet. And I very slowly brought the rifle around and shot the quail at point-blank range. And as soon as I had done that, I felt horror. Sorry. I'm still very affected by this. And that was the moment when I decided I would never kill another living being. So it happened to me long before I got to Buddhism. You know, maybe if there are multiple lives, I've been through this routine before.
Eric Kolvig is a Buddhist scholar and meditation teacher who lives in Embudo, New Mexico. We'll hear more stories from Eric later, specific encounters with cockroaches and pocket gophers that put his compassionate philosophy to the test. This is Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution, online at peacetalksradio.com. Today, we're considering ways to promote compassion to animals as a means of nurturing a more compassionate, peaceful world overall. In a moment, three women who work with organizations which all stress prevention of cruelty to animals. Right after this break. You're listening to Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution, online at peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio.com, where you can also hear all of the programs in our series, order CDs, sign up for a podcast or newsletter, and it's also where you can make a tax-deductible contribution to our nonprofit media organization that produces this program. Donations from people like you help us continue this work, protecting part of the media landscape for talk about peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. Any amount will help, so seriously, do your part at peacetalksradio.com. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls, and today, how practicing compassion to animals while protecting animals might also foster more compassion between people. Carol Boss continues the conversation now with three guests. From Animal Protection of New Mexico, Heather Ferguson. From the New Mexico Animal Humane Association, Peggy Weigel. And from Buffalo, New York's Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, Beth Shapiro.
There are multiple studies that show a link between animal abuse and human violence, and reports indicate that children who abuse animals or witness animal abuse are more likely to commit violent crimes as adult. Heather Ferguson, working for Animal Protection of New Mexico, you see many animal cruelty cases. What would be an example? Can you think of an example of a case which illustrates the correlation between animal abuse and violence in the family or the community?
I can, actually. I can think of a few. First, there are many studies that substantiate that. The Chicago Police, in fact, just did a study over a course of 3 years that was released last year, and it showed that 70% of animal crime offenders have been are usually arrested for other illegal narcotics and are linked to a narcotics background. 65% of animal crime offenders have been arrested for aggravated domestic battery, aggravated assault, and 70% of people that have been arrested for animal crimes have also been arrested for other felonies.
What about something that you've witnessed or been involved with that is a good illustration of the relationship between animal abuse and violence?
Specifically, there was a case that has just wrapped up as of a few months ago, and it was down in Capitan, New Mexico. And this speaks to what you had spoken of with family violence and its effect on children. There were three juveniles that have now all been sentenced for committing extreme animal cruelty to a kitten. This little kitten was named Ruckus, and it went to an elementary school every day to play with the school children for lunch. It was a little black and white, you know, just a little tabby cat with little white feet. And what had happened was the children showed up to school the next morning to find this kitten tortured, mutilated, and hung from the flagpole. From that, the juveniles in question, of course, were intimidating other students and trying to keep the information away from law enforcement agencies. So we as an organization issued a reward to try to get the students who we knew had information about who had tortured this cat to come forward, and they did. As with all juvenile animal crimes, it's written into statute that they need to go through a series of psychological testing and counseling prior to the adjudication of a case. It was found that in all three cases, these children had come from violent backgrounds, violent homes, parents. It was a broken homes, parents who were not engaged in their lives and were certainly far from setting a good example for these kids.
Peggy Weigel is the executive director of Animal Humane Association in New Mexico. What's the link between learning compassion toward animals and practicing compassion toward people? And how does one inform the other?
Well, I think it's part of the whole cycle of life. And if you can be kind to animals, you probably are more likely to be kind to people and vice versa. And I think overall, it just makes you think more about your actions. And particularly with animals, to see them suffer really helps you reconsider any kind of, you know, violence or aggression towards them and towards people.
Do you have a response, Heather?
We talk about, Gandhi's famous quote, that the way that a community treats their animals, you know, raises the compassion of the community and the care for how everyone treats each other in the communities. And I think that that's exactly what we do here, is that we teach people that, you know, animals are the voiceless, the powerless, and the defenseless, as are our community's children. And it is only by raising both of them to care for one another that we can have a peaceful society.
You know, I think there's one other interesting link and things that animals can teach us. That whole unconditional love component that dogs have, even when they have been abused, particularly if you're a child, when you have that level of love coming, sometimes undeservedly from a pet, I think it gives you sort of the courage that you could reach out to people and perhaps get that same response back, because that pet taught you that good things can come your way. And it's subtle, but I think that, you know, a lot of us aren't very brave in our lives, and sometimes pets can really help us do that reaching out, because we were rewarded when we reached out to them.
Beth Shapiro is the Humane Education Director for SPCA in Buffalo, New York. And Beth, your organization has a program called TLC, Teaching Love and Compassion. In what ways does this program approach the problems of abuse and violence?
We work with students to develop valuable life skills. We work with students who essentially live in the inner city of Buffalo. We bring the students to the SPCA after school for 5 weeks every day. And what we do is we work with them and talk about life skills, dog fighting, animal problems in our community, violence towards each other. What we try to do is hopefully have them develop different aspects of kindness, respect, caring, compassion, empathy, and hopefully to increase those feelings. Four teams are paired up, and they have to work together to train a shelter dog. As they're working with this animal, they're building a relationship, and they're building those all those feelings of kindness and respect. And they're also getting frustrated when this animal, who can be an obnoxious shelter dog and may be in need of some training and manners, may frustrate them. And what do they do with that frustration? And how do they connect with this animal? And it essentially, it's a parallel situation. They're looking at an animal that is exhibiting some of the same behaviors as they are. So it's really working with the students to understand how to be more patient and find different solutions and alternatives to violence.
And just mention the circumstances of these young people that you work with. You talked about inner city, but Buffalo has a high rate of poverty. Is that not correct?
That's correct. We are the second poorest community in the country. And the students are selected based on a history of problematic behavior, poor grades in school, suspension. They may be in foster care. There may be a number of different issues and reasons why they're chosen. And they're chosen through the administration of the school as well as the staff from SPCA.
Do you have a story that you can share with us in regards to a graduate of the TLC program that you think really illustrates the value of that program of bonding young people with animals?
I did bring, this is one of our graduates, it's something she wrote on the day of her graduation from the TLC program, and her name is Jordan. And Jordan wrote, "TLC means to me patience, because when I first started to train my dog, Cisco, I could not get him to stay or listen for anything, and I did not have any patience with dogs or with humans. Now I am a more honest, helpful, and kind person. I hope that the next group gets to learn as much as I did about animals and people and will have patience and integrity with each other."
Okay, thanks, Beth. Who can address the question of why people abuse and perhaps talk about the mindset of a person who is an abuser of animals? Peggy?
Well, there have been a lot of studies done on this, of course, and the Humane Society of the United States is a really good resource to understand more about this problem. And they cite a number of reasons why people participate in domestic violence. against animals. Probably the first is to demonstrate and confirm that this individual has power and control over that household. Sometimes they'll abuse the animals to make sure that the family keeps secret that there's violence occurring in that house, because if the pet is put at risk, sometimes they can get them on their side to keep it quiet. A lot of times the abuser will do it to isolate the victim, perhaps the mother, from the children themselves. Very often it's to keep the victims from leaving the household because they are afraid that if they leave, the abuser will kill the pet or torture the pet. And certainly at Animal Humane, one of our programs is an emergency shelter program for the pets of victims of domestic violence. And I personally take the phone calls and work with some of the women's shelters here in town. And when I talk with these people who have been victimized, it's you can just feel their pain, you can feel their terror, but they're so intent about getting their pets into a safe place because many of the batter shelters do not take pets. So they stay in the home until they can find a safe place for the pet. And we take them in and let these women and sometimes men get into better situations so that they can reunite the family.
How do you think kids are likely to treat animals without any guidance at all?
I believe that children are born inherently good. You know, I think that they all, you know, children and animals both, I think, are always the voiceless and the defenseless members of our society. And I think that it's only when they are exposed to violence from adults, you know, for the examples that are set for them, or from frustrations, because if they are not raised with the compassion and the support of a loving and a nurturing family, many times they vent those frustrations out on things that are smaller than them because they need something that they need to take power and control over and to vent out their feelings.
You know, kids like to squash bugs and you know, maybe even burn ant holes. It seems to be a pastime of a lot of youngsters. If parents do notice their children doing these kind of things, how can they respond to this behavior? What would be some practical words of advice?
I think that what I hate to hear is to hear any parent say, "Boys will be boys." That is never the answer. It is always to try to teach your children compassion and that all living things feel pain and are part of the world that they need to live in. And that they do live in, and that they need to ensure that they are taking care of both of their friends and being kind to their friends, being good members of society, and that means looking out even for the smallest members of our society.
Yeah, I think humane education at an early age is so critical. It's appalling to me how many adults still believe that dogs, cattle, horses have no feelings, don't perceive and do not have any kind of emotions and the like. And I think a lot of that just has to do with how people have been raised. And anybody that has been raised in a compassionate household wouldn't dream of thinking that these beasts, you know, and pets have no emotions and no feelings.
Beth, through the work that you've done with SPCA and the TLC program, do you have anything to add in terms of advice for parents and how they can respond to behavior that we've been talking about?
Well, I truly believe, having a 4-year-old son myself, I don't agree with the comment about boys will be boys. What we try to impress upon parents is to talk to their children. If your child's outside and is, squashing an ant or whatever it may be, it sometimes just takes a few minutes. Use those teachable moments and teach them that the ant lives outside. This is its home. We live in our home. The ant not this is their home, and try and relate it back to them. And if you continue to do that, it'll work. Through our TLC program, we even have a program. One of our lessons that we do together is called the SPCA ARC. And we bring all of the students. They all become an animal. Somebody may be a mosquito. Somebody may be an ant. Somebody may be a horse. And who would you bring on the SPCA ARC? And what's their value and what's their purpose? And as we move through the lesson, the students start to see that every living thing has a purpose. And I really truly believe that if we start with our youngest ones and using those teachable moments, we'll be in a better place.
Beth, in talking about the TLC program, touched on that human-animal bond that they try to develop between the animals that come to the program and the young students. What does the Animal Humane Association do to foster the human-animal bond and stop and prevent the mistreatment of animals? What other programs?
Well, we do a number of things. I think the first program that we're very proud of, we're the only shelter in New Mexico that does this program. It's an ASPCA trademarked program called Meet Your Match. And the idea is to make sure that when an adopter and their family come into our shelter, that they're not just picking a dog or a cat based on its looks. They're really picking that animal based on the suitability of that pet's temperament with their family and the family's lifestyle. And we spend a lot of time coaching and discussing how they're going to keep the pet. And we also make sure that every member of the family comes and meets the pet before we adopt it out, because we want to make sure that, you know, the mom and the kids come in and adopt a pet, and that pet doesn't end up going home to a place where maybe dad really doesn't want the pet and the pet is abused. So we do that. We also focus a lot on humane education, and that can take the form of an annual camp that we do. We've suspended it for a couple of years for logistical reasons, but we take 7 to 13-year-old children and teach them humane, compassionate care for their pets. And we think that that's very important to catch them at that age. And often they'll go back home and do some education with their own family. We do a lot of tours at the shelter where we talk about the value of pets as family members. Don't chain them in the backyard. Don't use them just as guard dogs. And then finally, the people that do come to our low-cost veterinary clinic, we do a lot of humane education, because a lot of these folks, maybe they've never owned a pet before. Maybe they've come from a background where these were just ranch animals and it was okay to kick the dog and things like that. So we do as much as we can to the people that are coming to Animal Humane for help.
Heather Ferguson, how does Animal Protection of New Mexico advocate for nonviolence?
Well, we also do community outreach with children. We participate in career days, which gives us an opportunity to go to the elementary schools and to speak with children about what we do, and to, you know, as they could approach working with animals as a career. Many times we see that the children that are in these homes where they can see in the backyard, as Peggy was saying, that, you know, that family has a dog chained up in the backyard, they can see that it's wrong, and they just need the tools and the language and the information to be able to take that home to their families. So we do a lot of community outreach like that.
I think, not to speak on behalf of Heather, but, you know, one of the things that APNM has done for the state of New Mexico, they have been one of the major forces in getting the anti-cockfighting legislation passed. And if that's not dealing with anti-cruelty, I don't know what is. I mean, they really worked so hard to get that bill passed. And we know that there are children very often at those cockfights, and to be able to remove those events from somebody's daily calendar, I think, is a huge stride forward.
That's Peggy Weigel from the New Mexico Animal Humane Association. We're also hearing from Heather Ferguson from Animal Protection of New Mexico and Beth Shapiro from Buffalo, New York's chapter of the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. We're exploring the link between learning compassion to animals and practicing compassion to people. We'll hear more from this panel and also more from Buddhist scholar and meditation teacher Eric Kolvig. You're listening to Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution, online at peacetalksradio.com. More after this break. This is Peace Talks Radio, the series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. At the end of our show, details on how you can help support this series. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls, and today we're talking about how promotion of compassion toward pets and all of nature's animals might help nurture a broader culture of peace in our world. In a moment, more with Eric Kulvig, a teacher of Buddhist-style meditation who's given this topic lots of thought. Right now, though, more with Peggy Weigel from the New Mexico Animal Humane Association, Heather Ferguson from Animal Protection of New Mexico, and Beth Shapiro from Buffalo, New York's chapter of the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. Beth told our host Carol Boss that their programs, teaching school kids to have more compassion to animals, are especially critical since dog fighting is something many of the children are familiar with.
80% of the students that we work with have been to or know somebody who dog fights, and this is very common in our community, in our neighborhoods, and it's something that is normal for these students to see. They also tend to be afraid of the dogs, especially certain breeds that are a part of dog fighting, and it helps us work with the students so they know how to approach a situation as far as going to dog fights, being asked to participate in dog fighting, but it also their fear of dogs. They're afraid of certain breeds of dogs, and this helps us let them know they can approach dogs when they should or they shouldn't approach dogs. It's just providing that knowledge to the students and what they should do and who they should call and who they should talk to. And we have quite an extensive dog fighting lesson, and we have been fortunate enough to even have the some of the Buffalo Bills and Buffalo Sabres, the hockey and football team, participate in these sessions, and it really seems to make an impact, especially after the situation that happened this past year with Michael Vick.
It seems it could be quite challenging because it looks like some of them grow up with the likelihood that they see this as part of their culture and might think that this is normal.
It definitely is part of their culture, and they do see it as normal. They just see it as something that where it's lucrative, and it might be a necessity for some families. They just don't know any better. So it's really getting the word out through our humane education programs and letting them know that there are alternatives, really, to have those, again, those feelings of compassion and empathy towards those animals, and that it's not just something to make money or if there are drugs involved and other situations happening.
Heather, if any of us observe animal abuse, animals out in the blazing sun all day in the yard, no water, no shade, or we witness people treating their pets roughly, what are some suggestions, some guidelines about what we can do?
I think first we always encourage everyone to call their local authorities, especially if you see an animal that is suffering and maybe in an immediate danger, especially in these hot summer months if they don't have water, if they don't have shade or shelter, and they're kept outside. And, you know, that's something that we need to get law enforcement over there right away and get animal control in there to get that animal out of a situation. But first and foremost, we encourage everyone to immediately call in their local authorities and get animal control over there to investigate.
So you don't suggest that people get directly involved with...
Many times I think that people are moved to try to get directly involved and find themselves caught in themselves in an illegal situation of either trespass, you know, breaking and entering to get into a backyard to get a dog out of a situation. And in fact, Tammy Grimes, who I know runs Dogs Deserve Better out on the East Coast, found herself in that exact situation where there was a chained dog in exigent circumstances. She took it upon herself to go onto the property and try to remove the dog from the situation and found herself being arrested for trespass. So we need to always try to bring in the local authorities first, and especially in dealing with any illegal animal fighting. That's an organized crime ring. People need to stay as far away from that as possible and not get themselves in trouble.
I'm guessing some animal abuse falls into this category, neighbors abusing neighbor dogs. How do you approach the mindset of non-pet owners in promoting compassion to animals?
Well, you know, I believe that we have a number of folks here that we work, you know, in Buffalo with the SPCA Serving Area County. We work with folks who don't have pets, that do have pets, and it's really just getting the message out. It's really it's telling stories, and really getting the word out about whether you want to own a pet or not, to be a responsible pet owner, but to really tell those stories. Stories are really the best way to connect with the public, as you all well know, and that seems to help bridge that disconnect.
Anyone else want to have a quick response to that? Peggy?
I think the value of storytelling is huge. I completely agree on that point. I think a good example is a little dog that was brought into Animal Humane last year that had – it was a Chihuahua. This dog weighed no more than 6 pounds. And it had been shot in its hind leg and its front leg by a shotgun. And the people didn't care enough about the dog to really get it the medical care it needed. And then finally they did bring it into us at a point where the dog had to have its leg removed. And this brave little dog sort of marshaled his energy and stayed alive, and he eventually became adopted. And he was adopted by a guy who just had a hip replacement. So here we have a lame man and a lame dog. And when they both got a little better, they went camping. And this little 6-pound dog saved the guy's life because he warned him that there was a bear attack coming. Now, that's the sort of story that I think you can share with a non-pet owner, that they will understand that there is a human-animal bond and that animals are there to love us and to protect us and to become really valuable parts of our lives. And I think that little story of Hopscotch, as we named him, shows that. And I think people learn from stories.
How do each of your organizations approach the issue of hunting? Does hunting provide any particular challenge?
Well, Animal Humane has a position where we do not support and do not agree with hunting. It's pretty short and sweet.
Animal Protection of New Mexico also shares in our mission statement, although we have no active campaigns at this time, that we do not support hunting. When we deal with the laws in regards to hunting, however, the laws that we have found that the Humane Society of the United States gets involved in at a federal level and those that we may ever get involved in at a local level are only ones that deal with egregious, cruel hunting practices such as bear baiting, which was essentially the practice of taking a pile of jelly donuts and sweets and putting it in the middle of a forest and luring the bears over, or things like canned hunts, internet hunting, you know, things like that.
What about the SPCA, Beth?
This is a question we often get from our students. And even when we go into the schools, do we think that hunting is bad? It's something that, you know, we shouldn't be doing. And what we try and do is let the students know that they need to form their own opinion, and but they need to have the knowledge to form their own opinion. And we try and provide them with some of those basic facts and things that they would need to know. We let them form their own opinion on it. However, it hopefully is an opinion, you know, that's based on fact.
What about meat eating?
Animal Protection of New Mexico does encourage a vegetarian lifestyle. It is just a public education campaign that we have in conjunction with other national organizations do as well. A few of us that work in the broadest of public policy arenas are vegans. And the reason for that is that not only because, you know, of course, that we believe in it, but we also work in broad public policy arenas, that we are not being hypocritical to what we are asking. You know, many times during the cockfighting ban, we were asked by state legislators, are you sitting here advocating for the eradication of fighting roosters, but you're going to go take off and eat a chicken salad? And we can genuinely say, no, we're absolutely not. And I think that that helps to give us support and foundation for what we're asking the public for.
Anyone have any last thoughts about how these anti-cruelty programs contribute to a more peaceful world?
Well, I think we live in an incredibly violent world. And, you know, from everything that we watch on TV to just even driving down most of our interstates is generally a violent experience. And I think that if we can teach that patience that student referred to and teach the compassion, that sometimes, you know, that teaches us to give people a little bit of a pass and a break when maybe they're not behaving exactly as we'd like them to.
I think that there's always a chance for reform, too, when we reach out and we do these animal cruelty programs. We have one member of our task force who is a former cockfighter who is now an animal control officer. And that is because he spent 16 years of his life being engaged in a cultural activity that at his heart and soul he didn't believe was right, but went along with it because that's how he was raised. At the age of 16, he got himself out of it and realized that his true calling was to care for animals, not to hurt them. And from that, he is taking what he learned and putting it to good use to eradicate animal fighting in our state. And I think that can happen with everyone.
Beth, any last thoughts about that?
I think that through all of our programs, no matter where we are, I think if we just keep trying and we make an impression, even if it's just on one student, it'll make a difference because hopefully that will then get passed along from that student to a brother, a sister, a neighbor, a family member, and hopefully that will become contagious.
That's Beth Shapiro from Buffalo, New York's chapter of the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. We also heard from Peggy Weigel from the New Mexico Animal Humane Association and Heather Ferguson from Animal Protection of New Mexico. And we close our program now with more from Buddhist scholar and meditation teacher Eric Kolvig, who was talking earlier in the program about his intention to catch and release all bugs and to never kill any sentient creature. Not always an easy philosophy to maintain, he told Carol Boss.
You have a story, I know, about cockroaches.
Mm-hmm.
If you could share that with us.
I'd be happy to. I have one about cockroaches and one about gophers. What's your preference?
Well, it was recommended. Maybe we'll have time for both. It was recommended that you tell us the
right
story about cockroaches.
Okay. Yeah, I'll be happy to. There's the most important meditation center, or one of the two most important meditation centers in my tradition, is a place called Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts. And in the mid-80s, I was on the board of directors of Insight Meditation Society. The place got overrun with cockroaches. And for most people, the choice about cockroaches is automatic. For us, it was anything but automatic. There were hours and hours of discussions. It came to the board level. We anguished over it. And eventually, we came out. My suggestion as a board member was there are alternative ways of controlling cockroaches, like wolf spiders, for example. bring in the wolf spiders. They take out the cockroaches. You don't have to kill them yourself. And I asked the staff to research alternative ways of controlling cockroaches. And we constituted what we called a killing committee. And it was three members of the board, and I was one of them, who would make the final decision. And so some weeks later, the executive director of Insight Meditation Society called me and said, the cockroaches are out of control. We have to kill them. I've called the other two members of this committee, and they've approved it, and now it's up to you. And I said, well, have you done the investigation? Have you done the research to find out if there are alternatives? No, I haven't. And I said, I can't stop you at this point. I feel like I can't prevent the decision to kill the cockroaches, but I'm not going to approve it. I'm going to stand aside, as the Quakers say. And sometime later, I resigned from the board of directors over that issue. So as I look back on it, many of your listeners who are hearing this are going to say, what is that all about? That's nuts. And I can understand that. But for us, it was a profound matter of conscience. And as I look back on it, I realized the kind of difficulty and pain and discussion that we went through. I bow to the integrity in it. No matter how the discussion turned out, no matter what the final decision was, we had to look deeply into our hearts. So it was, I think it was a good experience for all of us.
So you want to share with us about pocket gophers?
Yeah.
Do they fit in your pocket?
No, well, they're very small. They're little gophers, and they can be real pests. They dig up your yard. They dig up your garden. They can actually get into the wiring of your house if there's external wiring. I live in an intentional community, a rural intentional community in New Mexico. And a few years ago, my neighbors were killing the pocket gophers. And I told them respectfully that I wouldn't be killing the pocket gophers on my land. We don't have any fences between our properties. And so one of my neighbors was really upset, you know, that essentially I was establishing a pocket gopher refuge, and pocket gophers would be safe on my property, and they could go repopulate their property. And so he came to me. He was really upset with me. And he described the importance of being stewards of the land and gave a really beautiful argument for the reason that we had to kill the pocket gophers. And my response to him was, I wish that I could accommodate you. I wish that I could be in accord with the values of this community, but I simply can't. It's inconceivable to me to kill these gophers. And I said to him, I quoted the Buddha saying, whatever you do to yourself because of the karmic return. And I said, I'm not going to do that to myself. And at some point he said to me, well, what do you think about our killing the gophers? And I said, well, I think that what you're doing to yourself, and I feel compassion. And his response was, I didn't want to hear that. So the story of the pocket gophers, and it's ongoing. My yard is totally dug up right now by many, many pocket gophers that have taken refuge on my property. And you know, it's really hard to maintain any kind of decent yard with them. And just recently, I got a have-a-heart trap, and I've been trying to trap them, live trap them, and carry them away and release them somewhere else, away from other people's homes. But they seem to be smarter than I am, and they don't go for the trap. So that's where we are with the pocket gophers as of now.
If part of not killing pests is to live with what they bring, what would you say to people about living with the results?
Mm-hmm. It's not my job to lecture to other people, so I can only speak about my own experience. I can encourage people to do what they can not to harm, to help and not to harm living beings. But it's true that pests bring inconvenience to us. That's why we call them pests. It's a four-letter word. So I think, it comes down to our level of understanding. On one level, your question says, well, you know, what do you think we should do? And actually, what we end up doing if we're on a spiritual path, it's not about thinking anymore. It's about an absolute gut reaction. I do not want to harm. And as you go deeper and deeper into the understanding that we are, there is only one reality here, that as I kill another being, I'm as well killing myself. As you go deeper and deeper into that understanding, even if you want to cause harm, there's something in the psyche that recoils from it, and it becomes actually impossible to do it. So I would say, you know, think about your comfort level in terms of dealing with pests. I've got a yard that's all dug up by gophers, and I've learned to live with it. And I'm now trying to catch the gophers and get them off my land. I've never been faced with the inconvenience, the discomfort, the result of having termites or carpenter ants in my home. And I actually can't tell you what decision I would make in terms of dealing with possibly having my home crumble apart around me because of insects. I don't know what I would do. But I do have the example of some Tibetan nuns in Tibet. At their nunnery was overrun with rats. And the nuns did what they could to deal with the rats, and eventually they chose to move out of the nunnery rather than to kill the rats. That may seem really extreme, but I can understand how they got to that place.
Eric Kulvig teaches Buddhist meditation and lives with the pocket gophers in rural Embuto, New Mexico. For links to our guests' websites and more on this discussion about the connection between compassion for animals and compassion for humans, you can visit our website, peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio.com, where you can also hear all of the programs in our series, order CDs, sign up for a podcast or newsletter, and it's also where you can make a tax-deductible contribution to our nonprofit media organization that produces this program. Donations from people like you help us continue this work, protecting part of the media landscape for talk about peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution. Any amount will help, so seriously, do your part at peacetalksradio.com. Additional support comes from the Oppenheimer Brothers Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation of New Mexico, the Peace Tales CD Project at peacetales.org, and KUNM at the University of New Mexico. Our website was designed by Genevieve Russell. Our webmaster is Gonzalo Rafat. Ali Adelman composed and performs our theme music. For Carol Boss, I'm Paul Ingles. Thanks for listening and for supporting Peace Talks Radio.